This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And with David Canfield.
Hello.
On this week's episode, we're going to talk about the round of cancellations around award season events and what it will mean for Oscar campaigns. We're going to talk about the Best Picture campaign for Spider-Man, No Way Home, and where that might go. We'll talk about Don't Look Up, the hot topic of Christmas break Twitter, and look ahead at the SAG Award nominations, which are coming out next week. And the episode will end with a conversation between our colleague Julie Miller and Murray Bartlett, the star of HBO's The White Lotus. So let's start with the wave of event cancellations that happened before the break. Rebecca, you and I talked about it briefly when we hopped on to talk about the Oscar shortlist. There were more since we recorded, to the point that I had to like hop on with an extra note that the Governor's Awards had been added to the list. And at this point, David and Rebecca, for you guys in LA, like there's nothing on the calendar, right? Like it's everyone's staying home, at least when it comes to big events like this.
Yeah, there are none.
How does it feel? I mean, it's weird and depressing, obviously, to be back in this phase of the pandemic. But awards wise, like, what do you think people are going to do from this point on to get their movies noticed?
Well, it's interesting because I was talking to a couple awards reps yesterday, and one of them pointed out what the value of those events is. And I had never really heard someone put this into words. But basically, when you're in those rooms, you can tell which films are simply respected and which films are beloved by the way those audiences react, right? So like Parasite, every room you were in, the audience would just go crazy for it, you know, when it would win or be mentioned. And that's the kind of sort of passion that gets captured in a room. And then you realize, okay, this film has something special behind it, you know, where other films are just sort of respected, you know, oh, you know, and they get sort of a polite applause. So I always was able to notice that, but this was the first time a rep had sort of explained that to me in words. And I thought that was a really smart observation of what will sort of be lost this month.
The AFI Awards for me are the best example of that. I remember Parasite, its whole cast being there a few years ago. They didn't even technically win one of the top 10 because they weren't eligible, but they won one of their special awards. And I remember getting there early and everybody wanted to talk to the Parasite cast. And I mean, like Leonardo DiCaprio was there and it was a really starry season. Renee Zellweger was there. Brad Pitt was there. They all wanted to talk to them. And that was the first time. And I remember actually like writing a column out of that week, just being like, I think this can win Best Picture, because you see in the moment the people who vote for the Oscars, the movie that they are obsessing over. And we didn't have that last year, obviously. Perhaps luckily we had a pretty clear front runner that stayed that way the whole way through. But this is a year where I think that would have been a really, this would have been a telling week, the Critics' Choice Awards and the AFI Awards, and just seeing how the momentum in the room felt, who was getting the applause, like Rebecca said, because I don't think we have a clear Best Picture leader right now, or even in most of the acting categories are pretty fluid. So I think we're just losing some sense of who's winning these awards this year.
I have a theory about Best Picture that developed over the holiday.
Okay.
Well, my friend and our colleague, Dan Daddario, the TV critic at Variety, one of the TV critics there, he went to go see Don't Look Up in theaters at the Paris Theater in New York City and texted me and some friends and said, that movie's winning Best Picture based on how the audience reacted to it. I have, over the course of the holiday, I watched it with my family. I have started to agree with him. And I think that not having in-person things now, a lot of stuff that did just under the wire of Omicron have big public screening industry events like Being the Ricardos, like Don't Look Up, will benefit from that. Like, that'll kind of seal them off. And also you have Don't Look Up massively available on Netflix. Anyone can watch it at any time. And it seems to be playing well. And so I don't know. I'm just wondering if the lack of in-person events right now, what that means as an advantage for some films that did kind of got in, they had like their big events or some of their big events right before, versus smaller movies that were maybe planning on, you know, a successive series of events starting in the new year.
Yeah, because it's not last year, you know, where Netflix didn't win Best Picture. It was Searchlight that won, but they had time to plan it and plan it like a strategy, knowing it would all be virtual. Like this kind of like halfway through interruption makes it so that Netflix has that advantage just by being everywhere, like you were saying, Richard. Like the nomad land method, I think probably wouldn't work in this case. You know, I was thinking about West Side Story because it also had a big premiere. You know, we had that first week in December where all these movies were suddenly debuting, and West Side Story was so warmly received, but it's not available in your house the way that Don't Look Up is. And I think you might be right, Richard, that that's a real advantage. So while we're talking about Don't Look Up, Richard, I also finally watched it over the holidays after it was the only movie that anyone in my family asked me about, which I is not a traditional Oscar bellwether, but at least tells me what real people actually care about. And anytime that I did open Twitter over the break, which I shouldn't have done because I should have just been living my life, people were just arguing over Don't Look Up all the time. And I had a hard time figuring out the contours of this debate. And Richard, maybe you can explain this better to me, as I believe the rap is that you as a film critic don't care about climate change and would actually happily watch the world burn so long as you don't have to see this movie again. Is that the general idea of the debate?
Well, yeah, I'm looking at, I have a little coal furnace that I use to power my computer and my recording stuff. So, yeah, I'm actually kind of pro climate change and fossil fuels and all that. The sort of line of thinking that emerged when the movie was premiering on Netflix, from a little bit from Adam McKay, who wrote and directed the film, but mostly from David Sirota, who is a former, he worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2020, I believe, or maybe 2016. He's an author, professor, and he consulted on the film. He has, like, I think, a story credit or something. Mm-hmm. He went a little bit wild on Twitter, just basically accusing any detractors of the film, but most notably critics from larger media outlets, of being at best passively complicit in the big media's narrative about climate change, which is to say they don't cover it enough or the right way. They're, you know, beholden to corporations versus their fellow man or their planet or whatever, which is a pretty insidious thing to imply about people who I know a lot of film critics. I myself am one, who work in good faith and I think are almost always, maybe with one exception I can think of, politically aligned with what the film is trying to say about this urgent crisis, but are just saying that the film doesn't say it in a good or productive way. I think the movie is better than I maybe thought when I first saw it. Like, I watched it again with my family because, like yours, Katie, that was the only thing that they really were curious about. And I appreciated it more the second time, but I still see a lot of flaws. I think that the central metaphor is a problem. And that's really what the bad reviews were saying. Not that, oh, the media is criticized in the movie, therefore we hate it, which is really what kind of Sirota was saying. And then going further into suggesting that film critics are or Crystal Ball actually kind of said this, that film critics are complicit in or worked to help create the climate crisis, which is a pretty off the, you know, like that's a pretty wild thing to say.
I caught a tweet from Mike Schur, who the creator of Parks and Recreation and various other TV shows, who, as far as I know, is not involved in Don't Look Up at all, but tweeted, "Somewhere in the chaos of this climate change fueled 100-mile-per-hour fire wind, a copy of the arts section is burning to ash, and it contains a 2.5-star review for Don't Look Up that says it's a, quote, a little on the nose." And that was the first thing I saw. I was like, okay, now I kind of see what everyone's fighting about.
you know, and I'll let you the rest of you guys talk, but I do want to say that there had been a line of from people who support the film, vaguely sort of in the realm of that critics didn't like it because it was too on the nose or it was too blunt and we couldn't be confronted with this hard truth. And my response to that is, the film is a fucking allegory. It's not actually about climate change. How can an allegory be blunt? That is a crazy thing to say about this movie. It is not blunt. If it was blunt, it would be about climate change directly, like the day after tomorrow, you know? Like, so I won't listen to that. That is a silly thing to say and a complete misreading of, like, how to read any text.
Well, David and Rebecca, we aren't critics, so therefore are immune from being accused of profiting off of climate change. But do you guys, I guess more broadly, how do you feel like this conversation is affecting the overall conversation around this movie, not just among, I think, righteously pissed off film critics?
I don't know that it's changed that much from how I felt before the break. You know, I said, I think on this podcast that it's going to be a really strong Oscar contender. And I believe that's true, that the Academy has proven that they love Adam McKay movies, which many don't like, but they do work for them. I think it's a really strong across-the-board contender. They don't really care about these controversies. Green Book won Best Picture not very long ago, and that was a Twitter talking point from beginning to end, and I don't think it really affected its standing. I think sometimes, in terms of who's actually voting for these, we can overblow, you know, how they're playing out in terms of like a Twitter discourse. But they vote for what they like, and I think they're going to like this movie.
Yeah, the only sort of side effect of this kind of discourse is it keeps this movie in the conversation.
Yeah,
in a much more prevalent way.
Definitely.
I'm always a little turned off by, and I don't know if this is specifically, I don't think in this case specifically for campaigning. I do think Adam McKay and obviously Leo really, you know, believe in this message. But this whole thing of this movie is important because of its message being sort of part of the awards campaign, like almost every film kind of creates a message to be part of its awards campaign like that. And obviously climate change is very, very important. But, you know, to me, that always just makes it feel a little icky to me as part of the awards messaging. But yes, I agree with David that I think the film has a very, very strong chance for many nominations. I'm not on the Best Picture winner boat, but, you know, I've been proven wrong many times.
Yeah, well, one thing I would caution against its Best Picture chances is that in the era of the preferential ballot, consensus tends to win the day. And for all that there was a lot of hand-wringing about Green Book, you know, it neared 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it had a sort of general likability that worked for most of the Academy. Don't Look Up is rotten, technically speaking. It's much more polarizing than any Best Picture winner we've seen in a really, really long time. And so that would be definitely a break with what we've seen from how the new voting system tends to work. So that would prevent me from predicting it to win right now, but stranger things have happened. So
that's a really good point, David, about the preferential ballot. Like you're right, obviously, that this is not a consensus pick. I have spoken to at least one award-winning actor who said, quote, that they fucking hated it. So, but I think another thing, you know, kind of what you were talking about, Rebecca, about, you know, is that in terms of campaign strategy, I fully, you know, accept and believe that the Academy is not paying attention to, you know, Christmas time Twitter wars. Like, and I think that that's fair. They shouldn't. No one should, actually. But that the movie, because it has this central metaphor, allegory, whatever, and there, you know, people can say, well, I get it. You know, I'm on the side of getting it.
Yeah.
And then you see how the movie is being defended by the people who worked on it. It does create a certain sort of tribalism that, you know, that I think can work for a movie's profile in the race, you know, like, oh, that's like a, you're either that person or not, you know, and I think that can help define the film's campaign in some weird way. But David, you're, you know, right in saying that, like, but that sort of outlier, fiercely defended movie, but maybe not widely loved movie, isn't really something that crossed the finish line because that's just not how the voting works.
I also wonder about the international appeal of this movie, and maybe Netflix has data that says it's like the most watched movie in every country. But it's so American in so much of its concerns. And we talk all the time about how the Academy is getting more and more broadly international. Like Green Book, like you said, like it's a obviously a specific story, but like has kind of universal themes in it. And this one is so like our current poison discourse that, you know, if you're a director living in Hungary, you're just like, oh, leave it. Let them deal with it. I don't want to think about this movie anymore.
Thomas Vinterberg is not voting for Don't Look Up, is what you're saying.
And his vote counts twice, weirdly enough, right, in the Academy. I mean, the obvious question this leads to, though, is like, if we don't think this is winning, what is winning Best Picture? Like, I keep thinking we're going to talk about this in specifically, but as I was saying to David earlier, I feel less clear on it now than I was before the break, which I'm very confused by at this stage in the race. Are you guys in the same place?
I'm confused.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Why are we confused? Who wants to explain where things stand?
Rebecca, why are you confused?
I think it's kind of what we were talking about in the beginning. I was sort of stalling on this conversation until we got to be at a bunch of events in January.
Yeah, because exactly.
I feel like every year, except for last year, I go around those rooms and say, what do you like? What's the biggest threat to your film? You know, and I remember being in a room with someone from who was not involved with Parasite. And I was like, I think that's your biggest competition. And they tried to deny it, but I could tell in their face, they were like, yeah, that's our biggest competition. And so not being in those rooms really seems to hinder my ability to make these predictions. I think every week I'm like, it's definitely this film. And then I switch, you know, it's just the whole sort of pace of our season is just totally messed up now.
I was just going to ask both of you, David and Rebecca, like, because, you know, our LA people, do you think there's a movie that really needed this season? A lot of these films have played at festivals. They've had their sort of first initial moment. But which contender do you think, if any, will really suffer because of this lack of public events right now?
I had one really specifically in mind, and that's West Side Story. It didn't get the Power of the Dog level festival blowout or something that Belfast also got. It doesn't have that just scale of something like Don't Look Up. It didn't do that well at the box office. It was such a late breaker that just to sort of take its temperature, I was really curious to see, say, at the AFI Awards, how the applause would be when its turn came up or something like that, because it's a really well-liked movie that it's hard to gauge just how much passion there would be for it, given its standing with the box office and things like that. So that's one that I'm really frustrated to see isn't going to get that, and we don't have a better idea of just how strong of a contender it is. I think we kind of have a sense of movies like Power of the Dog and Belfast. They've already gotten to have so many events, and that's why if you look at most prediction charts, those are the two that are still being predicted the most frequently, because they've had their big rollouts. They've had a ton of in-person screenings. They've had tastemaker things hosted by celebrities and Academy members. And we know that for very different reasons, these are two movies that are going to do well, at least on nominations day. And so those are the two that, you know, just by default, I would have to think are out front. But beyond that, those movies that didn't have that earlier opportunity are now, I think, in a disadvantage.
I was also thinking about being the Ricardos and specifically Nicole Kidman, because I think last month we started talking about how she was looking like a real Best Actress winning threat. She already has an Oscar, but she, you know, even for the detractors of the movie, her performance really seemed to stand out. And she was one of the people who was going to be honored at the Palm Springs Film Festival Gala, which was supposed to happen this Thursday and was canceled entirely. I mean, there's a ton of people at that. Like, being honored at that is not a sign of something, but that seemed like a great place for her to give a speech and to be funny and charming, which she always is, and maybe really build ahead of steam from there.
Yeah, I agree.
And now the Best Actress race feels really confusing, as it has for a long while now. And I don't know, I guess the SAG Award nominations coming next week is kind of our next benchmark for getting some clarity. But in terms of like seeing someone in a room giving a speech, we got a long time to wait.
Well, there is the Golden Globes press conference on Sunday.
You know, we should say, like, by the time you hear this, we might have more clarity. But as we discuss this, Rebecca, you got in touch with the Globes yesterday and got no information about what they have planned, right?
Yeah, they said something is coming, but I think we all know that they're not going to have, you know, talent there. So
we knew that even before.
Yeah. So it won't give us any speeches that you know, we want to hear. So I assume it's some sort of press release sort of situation, but we should know probably by the time this airs what exactly it's going to look like.
Do you think there's a silver lining for anyone in all of this shutdown? Like, is there a movie that people have more time to catch up on screeners? Like, I wonder about The Lost Daughter, which has premiered on Netflix finally and was getting its share of Twitter conversation, less insane than Don't Look Up, as far as I could tell. It had a festival run and now people are talking about it. Like, does it get to benefit from this at all? Or does another movie get a bump?
I was going to say, to Richard's point, The Lost Daughter and Don't Look Up had a really nice, clear holiday break lane to generate a lot of discussion, get a lot of eyeballs, and at least by people who matter, I think were largely well-liked. So they both really benefited particularly. And then I wonder about foreign language contenders. Like, Drive My Car has had such an impressive run with Critics Awards. Mm-hmm. Rare is the film that wins New York and Los Angeles Best Picture prizes and doesn't get a Best Picture nomination. Granted, a movie this out far of, you know, what that conversation looked like a month ago would not, it's a different case. But, you know, I wonder if it's a movie that people will make more of an effort to catch up on without all that noise happening around them. So it could help some of those specialty players as well.
Mm-hmm. Or I guess them and anyone else who's based in another country who wouldn't be able to make it to get to these events in LA, right, who then not have the advantage of virtual platforms, even if virtual campaigning is like no one's idea of a good time at this point.
No.
I mean, this is such, I think, an outlier at this point, but another film that I watched with my family over Christmas was Come On, Come On. And that plays really well on a screener. And
yeah.
It went over very well in my house. I think we were all weeping at the end, like, and I'd seen it already. And I think similarly, you know, The Lost Daughter, where, you know, the subject matter might seem a little alienating. Oh, what is it really about? You know, maybe it feels too literary or something. I don't know. But like, who in the Academy, who cares about this stuff, votes for SAG Awards, whatever, isn't going to be like, oh, I'm not going to watch Maggie Gyllenhaal's film. Of course they are, you know,
yeah,
and then
they
has the Olivia Colman appeal and the Ed Harris appeal and the Dakota Johnson appeal. And I think that once that initial hurdle of interest is crossed pretty easily, then there's a lot in that movie for people to grab onto. And so I think that The Lost Daughter is definitely one of those movies that could benefit from, weirdly, from all this shutdown stuff, because it had a great Telluride run. And, you know, it's been at festivals. It's had its sort of public moments. It may be not enough, but some at least.
It also has some of the most vivid scenes of a parent trying to get work done with their kids around that have ever been captured on film. And a lot of people are going to be relating to that in the coming weeks. So
empathizing with their nannies and, you know.
If anyone has time to watch this movie amid childcare, they may find a lot to relate to. Well, we should also talk about Spider-Man, in terms of movies that could get a bump right now. It's the biggest hit in the country. I assume it still is. It's like one of the very few unmitigated bright spots in the box office, and it's getting a Best Picture campaign. The FYC ads are out there. I'm not sure anyone can tell quite how serious it is, if it's more of like, yes, we will do this campaign because it's the right thing to do by this movie, or if Disney has real hopes there. I have not seen Spider-Man, so I can't weigh in on whether or not it's worthy, but does anyone feel like it's possible for it to try something here?
Well, I mean, it's single-handedly saving the
theatrical model, right?
Like, which is not nothing.
No, exactly. It's not. It look, that movie does not have the sort of grand vision quality of Black Panther, which did get a Best Picture nomination. You know, Black mm-hmm. Panther was a sort of like rare event in that world of franchise stuff. But you know, the box, it's a solid enough movie, I think. You know, and it does. Spoiler alert. At this point, weeks later, you know, happily bring in Spider-Man properties past, and so it's a real triumph of, you know, managing actor schedules and getting studio executives from rival studios to agree on things. Like, so
that's
maybe
the kind of thing that when you put that at FYC, it really inspires people. Like a triumph of scheduling.
Yeah. Isn't it incredible what the CEO of Disney and the CEO of Sony did together? Yeah. But you know, producers are the ones who get Best Picture, so maybe there's something there.
I would not be surprised if it lands, say, in the PGA top 10, to exactly that point. I mean, we've seen over the years a big box office breakthrough kind of start to generate this kind of momentum. I remember the first Quiet Place landed on the PGA 10. Avengers Endgame got a similar kind of campaign. It didn't go very far. Mm-hmm. It happens every so often. It doesn't usually translate to an Oscar nomination for Best Picture. And I, again, think sometimes the Academy is a little bit generalized and they're a little bit more finicky about this stuff than we give them credit for. So I still think it's pretty unlikely. But yeah, I was on Deadline and I saw a bunch of ads there. So I was like, okay, it's happening. And it was pretty well received, and that helps it too. So because of where we are with theaters and what it's done, I don't think you can rule it out. It's a kind of unprecedented situation, but it's just not a movie that would generally be nominated for Best Picture.
I think it's a very steep uphill road for it to get a picture nomination. But, you know, I do think Feige is sort of brick by brick putting superhero movies, Marvel movies in the minds of voters so that in 5 years, you know, they are taken more seriously when it comes to awards. You know,
that's a great point.
I think maybe this is just a stepping stone for him to sort of get these films considered.
Or even like a WandaVision. I mean, it's all sort of every year now there is something he's talking about is this should be taken more seriously than you're taking it. And eventually that's going to become a lot more normalized.
Well, yeah, another spoiler alert. I'm just wondering if because Andrew Garfield is so charming in Spider-Man No Way Home, if that helps his Tick, Tick, Boom campaign at all. You know, I mean, I think that maybe he didn't need that much help, but like he's now in this hugest movie of the past 3 years. I believe it's the highest grossing movie since 2019. You know, that he's just kind of in a lot of people's consciousnesses right now, but you know, Tammy Faye too. So I wonder for him if that helped for the other movie.
I mean, we were all in a meeting a couple weeks ago that happened like the day or two after Spider-Man had first screened, and Andrew Garfield's name came up, and everyone was just like, "Oh my God, yeah!" Like the love for Andrew Garfield had just reignited in this profound way, and I can see that happening on a wider scale. So let's talk about the SAG Awards. We mentioned their nominations are coming out next week. We'll talk about them on next week's episode, and we'll have some formal predictions up. I do think it'll give us some clarity on all these acting races we're talking about and probably see a good number of familiar names like Will Smith, Kristen Stewart, Nicole Kidman, etc. Maybe we can go around, start with David. Anything you're especially eager to see happen or not happen when these nominations come out next week?
There's always one ensemble nominee that is not in the Best Picture conversation, like we think it is, it suddenly gets thrust into it. So I'm wondering if a movie like The Harder They Fall with Netflix, which has a cast alone that I think a lot of people will vote for, or then on the other side a little bit, something like Coda, which could really prove it's a really strong player, could get into that ensemble five and prove themselves in a way that you know, they've been a little bit, both have been underestimated in different ways. Harder They Fall is not at all in the conversation. And CODA's, I think, considered a lower tier Best Picture nominee right now. And those are two that have, in a different way, really broad appeal for a group like SAG. So those are two movies I'm looking to see if they can break through in a big way.
Rebecca, how about you?
Yeah, I think CODA was the one I was going to mention as well. I would really be excited if that could land a ensemble nomination. And then the other one I was kind of wondering about is Nightmare Alley. I mean, just because its cast is just full of such respected actors. And it's also, I think, very much sort of on the bubble. And this could really give it a boost if it got that ensemble nom.
Richard, what are you excited to see or not see? What are you rooting against?
Don't Look Up. No, I'm not rooting against Don't Look Up, because I think that the actors are for the most part good, and I think it'll definitely be in there. It's quite an ensemble. I think that this is an obvious answer, but like, I hope that all the sexy young street gangs of West Side Story get to be, you know, like included in that party. And, you know, I think that would be a good thing for that movie. I think it would be interesting to see if the Dune ensemble is rated as like, you know, that movie has a lot of spectacle. The performances are less spoken about, but like people like Rebecca Ferguson are great in it. So I have a feeling that the Academy will embrace big studio stuff as a way of like, you know, showing industry strength, but I wonder how SAG will fall on that, because there are a lot of smaller but much more actory movies that could maybe spoil the fun for the big studio stuff.
Well, this is a maybe recency bias. We just talked about The Lost Daughter, but like that movie has a great ensemble, and Olivia Colman is a real strong acting contender from that, and I would very much expect her to see her show up in Best Actress, but like maybe that pops up in there. You know, I think Mass's campaign has kind of petered out a little bit because it's so small, but like maybe The Lost Daughter is the step up in terms of size from that as a small movie to get in there.
And Paul Mescal has promised to wear short gym shorts to every awards show that he's
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
at.
The greatest so unfair advantage he has. Yeah.
You have to pray it's not over Zoom, though. It's also always a good, you know, a good indication of a front runner if they can get into the ensemble five, you know, with the exception of something like Nomadland, which would never have been nominated for Best Ensemble. It's pretty rare for a Best Picture winner to not make that five. So if Belfast or Power of the Dog, which have, you know, slightly smaller casts, but certainly, you know, lots of potential Oscar nominees within them, don't make that five, that'll be a red flag for those campaigns for sure. Or King Richard is another one.
Yeah. I'm also keeping an eye on House of Gucci, which has a big cast doing a whole lot. And again, a strong actress contender in Lady Gaga. But, you know, that could pop up there. And then all of a sudden we'll be talking about its Best Picture chances in a way we haven't been recently.
Yeah. To that point, this is also a test of I am always a little bit frustrated by those kinds of first very curated guild screenings that less, let's say, critically acclaimed movies have done, like House of Gucci or being the Ricardos, and they're usually packed with SAG members, and they're, you know, always very effusive reactions at the end. So, you know, this is where those movies would hit if they are to hit. So I'm watching for that. And then one other movie I really wanted to bring up for SAG is Licorice Pizza. I think in some areas it's a movie that's being underestimated a little bit in the Best Picture race because of, you know, I've spoken to some voters and they just absolutely love this movie. And I think it hits a really particular Hollywood LA chord. And if it can win, it would show up here because it has it's so packed with big names who admittedly only pop up briefly, but it has a lot of that particular appeal.
This is how we start the momentum for Bradley Cooper's Best Supporting Actor nomination for that movie,
and,
which
yeah,
I want
one to
desperately.
Look out for too.
It would be a miracle if he showed up, but I would be ecstatic in supporting actor.
I wonder, though, if it would that mean the whole Haim family gets included in the ensemble? Are they in enough of the movie?
Are they on a solo title card?
Are they on a solo title card? I think
would that be impressive the first time an entire family?
I think the parents share a title card, if I remember correctly. So they might. But I think each individual sister might be included, which is wonderful.
The tragedy would be if Being the Ricardos makes it through, only four of those actors would be nominated for Best Ensemble, the main four. Tony Hale, Elliot Shockett, all those people are on group title cards, so they would not be included in that nomination.
It's just so crazy. I mean, the way that the SAG determines who gets the nomination or not, like, obviously you have to draw a line somewhere, but it does feel like every year something makes us slam our heads against a wall in terms of who gets eligible. So maybe that'll be it.
Yeah. They should have just done in the solo title cards so they could get a SAG nomination and probably a win. That was silly of them.
It must be some kind of thing that agents negotiate intensely. Yeah, we should have like an anonymous agent come on someday and explain all this to us.
It's like how they really negotiate hard for, you know, with blank and blank, yes, you know, to get that and at the end of the credits. That's a big deal.
Yeah, my favorite title card in the, or my favorite credit in the entire year, which like with Judith Light and Bradley Whitford as Stephen Sondheim from Tick, Tick, Boom. It's really good. Well, we should talk about TV, too, because we're going to hear in a little bit from our colleague Julie Miller talking to Murray Bartlett, who I think is a really strong contender from The White Lotus. I realized today that there is no ensemble category for limited series or miniseries, which is nuts because you get so many of the best ensembles in that specific category. So it'll have to be individual performers from The White Lotus and other shows showing up there. But yeah, I mean, SAG's going to be really different from the Emmys. It's a lot different eligibility. Any shows you guys are eager to see show up?
Squid Game.
It's going to happen.
I'm so excited. I think that's such an interesting shift in what gets nominated at this event. And yeah, I do think it's going to happen.
So Squid Game, a drama series by the SAG definition.
Yeah. And Netflix is going for it. So And you know, there was no show that was more talked about than that one this year. So it's definitely deserving.
I didn't realize Squid Game was set up as not a limited series.
Oh yeah, they're already talking about season 3. They're not giving up on that one yet.
David, you wrote a great piece that ran over the break about Squid Game and how they're going for it. You're pretty confident it's going to work out.
Oh yeah, I mean they flew the whole cast out here for SAG meet and greets. The director was like the biggest celebrity in LA that week. He was like very overwhelmed by the amount of agents and industry people who wanted to meet him. They did a full court guild press for that show, and it's really a strong challenger to Succession, I think, for that win, just because it was so widely watched, and it's kind of, you know, it has that kind of Parasite appeal when Parasite won ensemble in a similar way of you would never think it because none of these actors were known to most of these voters, if not all of them, beforehand, but they have fallen in love with them. So I think it's a really interesting contender there. And then I just binged Yellow Jackets over the break, and I'm fully obsessed with it. So I'd love to see it crack the five.
Because that is going to have a second season as well. That's not limited.
Yep.
It's funny how hard it is to know. I mean, also like Big Little Lies like changed it up on us. So there's no logic to these rules. There's so many shows that we haven't gotten to talk about for Emmys yet. Like Only Murders in the Building is something I'd be really excited to get to talk more about. I mean, Mayor of Easttown is still going to be around, crazily enough. White Lotus, as I mentioned before, I've been wondering about Station 11, which is the other December show that people seem to be talking about a lot. So hopefully it feels exciting in a way that sometimes TV awards start to feel like they drag on forever. But we've got new titles in the mix here.
I do feel like, at least in drama, all these shows are going up against Succession, which may be hard to beat. So we can't, you know, ignore that big winner. So that's also, you know, worth keeping in mind.
A year ago, the people, or was it 2 years ago? I don't remember anymore. But people were very surprised when Jennifer Aniston won a SAG for The Morning Show. And I'm seeing it rated as The Morning Show pretty highly on some Variety SAG predictions anyway. But like that thing is dead, right? Like people really loathe
yeah,
second season.
Yeah, that surprises
season,
so. Me. I would be surprised. You never know. The thing is they don't do supporting categories. So say in that TV drama actress field, like, I would imagine Sarah Snook gets nominated there opposite, say, Jennifer Aniston. But even could someone like J. Smith Cameron get in? Because that has in the past happened where when SAG loves a show, they just fill the field. Like Julia Garner and Laura Linney were nominated for Ozark opposite each other a few years ago. So that'll be something to look for, too.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
Okay, well, this SAG conversation leads us directly into Julie Miller's conversation with Murray Bartlett, who was among the many standouts from The White Lotus, playing Armand, the hotel manager. So let's listen to that conversation.
Well, I'm so excited to speak with you. you had one of the most amazing performances this year, and you got to do some of the most fun things that I feel like any TV character got to do, just in terms of living out that unhinged roller coaster and kind of letting into all of your wildest, I guess, vices. I couldn't believe when I spoke to the casting director, Meredith Tucker, that she had no idea what your character's fate would be when she cast you. Do you remember how much you were told about the character?
I didn't know that she didn't know anything. That's so fascinating. Yeah, I knew nothing. I had just the scenes that I was auditioning with. I didn't have the first script yet. But, I mean, I had a couple of scenes that were very kind of comprehensive, and I had some big speeches in it. So you got a real sense of what an amazing character that Armand is. And also, I'm just, like, a huge fan of Mike White, so I was sold before I read it, to be honest. But also, like, the whole show, I think, is so beautifully written, and that character is so amazingly written. So it was, hooked me from the first words.
In your first conversations with Mike, what kind of references did he give you for Armand? Did he refer you to other characters? What was he kind of using to describe that personality?
No, interestingly, we didn't really talk a lot about the character ever, really. Like, it was sort of just on the fly playing with stuff. And I mean, talking about things as they came up, as we were shooting the show, but there wasn't a lot of talk beforehand. I mean, that's partly because of COVID. Like, we were a long way away and everybody was kind of managing all that kind of craziness. But the one thing that we did talk about was wanting to keep Armand tethered to some reality and not let him kind of completely be a sort of a caricature or something that didn't feel somehow real, which is what I was really focused on in the audition. Is I was like, oh, this is an amazing character, but I mean, in my own sort of sensibility, I guess, but also in the spirit of Mike White, like, these are real characters, you know, and it's interesting, you know, you see people in life and you're like, oh, my God, if you put that character on film, you'd never believe it, because there's a lot of characters in real life that are larger than life, you know, so, but you have to find those moments where you kind of anchor them in reality. Otherwise, they just do feel like over the top and not real. So that was one thing that he spoke about. Well, that was one thing that he spoke about responding to in my audition, which was a great compliment for me. And also what we kept kind of, that was sort of our touchstone throughout, when especially when we were doing all the crazy shit that Armand got to do.
So how did you tether him to reality? I read you have a little bit of a background in hospitality. Were you drawing on those own experiences?
I sort of based him loosely on someone that I have met in some ways. I mean, that's sort of the wrong way to say that, because the character was beautifully written. So there was really wasn't a ton to embellish. It was really specifically written and written in a very detailed way that, you know, there wasn't a lot. Maybe that's why we didn't talk about the character that much, because it was a lot of it was there, you know. But I did have one very strong reference point, and also my own experience in hospitality, and have friends who work in hospitality or in that kind of situation where you're handling, you know, obnoxious people. Or just, you know, just handling people in a kind of a hospitality sort of scenario where people just, you know, we turn into monsters. We can, you know, we have this sort of expectations and sort of feel like we deserve all sorts of things, otherwise we lose our shit, you know. So,
well, you shot out of order. How did you possibly keep track of one Armand's like patience level, tolerance level, like where he is in terms of breaking point, but also towards the end of the episodes when he's starting to use all these different drugs? How were you choreographing and keeping track?
I mean, I pretty much like drew a map because you know, it was during COVID. We were shooting, we had a very tight shooting schedule, and we were shooting completely out of order. And we were shooting in this resort in Hawaii that was closed for, we had the run of it for the first, you know, month and a half, and then it opened up at sort of a month and a half or so in. And we were, so we were shooting a lot of the common areas of the hotel, so that when people arrived, you know, real guests at the hotel, we could just shoot in the rooms. And a lot of my scenes are in the common areas of the motel, of the five-star resort. So a lot of my stuff was up front in the shooting schedule, and we were shooting, you know, sometimes from almost all of the episodes in a day. So I, you know, I really relied on Mike, but I really did have to map it out, particularly with the drug taking, because, you know, like I'm taking uppers and then downers, and like, you know, I wanted to kind of really make sure that I was on track with that stuff. So it was actually fun. Like, it was a little daunting in the beginning when we started shooting. I was like, oh my God, we're just like jumping all over the place, as you do normally anyway, but particularly in this situation. But then it became kind of a fun puzzle, you know, to map it out and try and kind of stay on track with that stuff.
Which drug was most difficult to portray the effects of?
Oh my God. I don't know. In a way, it was harder to portray not being on a drug. like the drug sort of gives you a kind of a really strong direction to go in. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's like a real kind of parameter there that you that you've got to work with. I mean, I found it really disturbing, and you know, I think it's really, it's unsettling, all that stuff. But it was also, as an actor, it was really fun to plot that out and to, you know, investigate what that was. But it's very, you know, I mean, it's a fun show, and it was really fun to make, but there was also a lot of really confronting things in it. And there was, for me, with Armand's addiction issues and all that stuff, as much as it was hilarious and fun shitting in a suitcase like doing some of the things that I get to do, it's pretty intense stuff that he's going through. So I did enjoy the process of working all that stuff on all that stuff, and I don't think there was one that was harder than the other.
Right. What was the most daunting scene? Do you remember being intimidated in the days up to filming one certain scene?
Not really. It was really just starting was daunting, because I loved the scripts and I loved the character, and he goes on such a roller coaster ride, get to go on such a roller coaster ride with him. And I wanted to do a really great job, you know? So, like, you're at the beginning, you're like, oh, shit, I hope I can, you know, I hope I can do all the things that I want to with this, and I hope it goes well. You never know, you know? You just sort of dive in. So, yeah, but I was equally excited. I think it was just also, it was COVID, so I hadn't met with Mike face-to-face ever before. There wasn't a lot of conversation before. We really kind of dove in when we got there. So I remember the first scene that I shot, and it was with Jake Lacey, and Mike did this thing I realized afterwards with a lot of the actors, where in the first scene that we shot, that those of us who hadn't worked with just tried all sorts of different things. So we did like a gazillion takes, and I was like, oh fuck, am I not getting what he wants? I don't know. I mean, we were having fun and stuff, but by the end I was like, I feel like I'm just not getting it. And then we came off set, and I looked at Jake, and I was like, man, like, I mean, what was going on there? And he was like, oh, don't worry. That's what he does when, like, in everyone's first scene, you're just like, you know, just seeing who you are and what you can do. And I mean, or maybe that was just Jake's take on it, but it kind of threw me for a loop for a second. I was like, ugh. Because we're, you know, there's so much in the script, and it was very clear what the show was in many ways, but we're also still kind of, in the beginning, you're trying to find the tone of the character and what the show is. So it was exciting, but also like a little scary, stepping off the cliff and being like, where are we? Is there a net here to catch us?
Right. Well, you mentioned not getting to meet Mike before you arrived on set. How was it in terms of co-stars? Because you are the nexus of this amazing ensemble cast. Did you get to meet anyone before you arrived to begin filming?
No, I hadn't met any of the cast before, and we didn't get to... We all arrived and went into quarantine, so we didn't get to meet each other or spend much time at all before we started shooting. Some people had a bit of a lag before they started shooting, but I was, like, right in. But then as we went along, you know, we were all staying in this resort together, so it was kind of like TV camp, and we all went down to the beach at the end of, you know, most of us, those of us who were still shooting, would go down at sunset every day and swim together. So it was this really beautiful bonding experience as we went along. It was really great. But yeah, in the beginning, I mean, as you said, like, this character is kind of like a sort of like a nexus. And it's such an amazing cast, and I got to work with all of them because I'm the hotel manager. It was so great. It was really, you know, I kind of got the coolest job in that way. Like, I get to be with all these cool people and do scenes with them. So it was awesome.
Wow. And so just to clarify, was there any sort of chemistry read even on Zoom or something with the co-stars or no? That's wild.
Nope. Nothing. Yeah. It's amazing.
Did it kind of help for the character then? Because I guess as the manager, you are meeting a lot of these people for the first time.
Yeah, I guess so. I never thought of it like that. But you know, again, we're shooting all the way out of order. So I think we shot the first scenes when they're all arriving on the last day. So, you know, so there wasn't like, by that stage, I knew them all, you know. But yeah, it was an interesting sort of evolution of getting to know each other. But we did, you know, I mean, I feel like we were immediately kind of bonded because it was such a unique situation, you know. It was the pandemic's going on. We all got pulled out of our COVID pods and taken to Hawaii, you know, to this beautiful place with these great scripts, with this amazing group of people. So we all were filled with so much joy at the beginning, and that was the jumping off point, you know. So that was, it's kind of a great place to start.
Right. I mean, it seems like a dream to be trapped on an island with Jennifer Coolidge, especially. She seems like she would just be so much fun.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty epic. You couldn't really design a better kind of dreamscape for yourself.
Right. Well, so Armand plays kind of a different role to each of the different characters, each of the different storylines. He serves different purposes to, I guess, different guests. I'm curious how much of those relationships were already written and established, and how much of that was like you getting to set, seeing how well you interacted with certain actors. Did Mike sort of spin off of the chemistry you guys had at all?
I mean, not in terms of the script. No, the scripts, Mike wrote those scripts in, I don't know whether someone else has told you this or maybe you already know. A lot of people don't seem to know this, and it's such a great thing to know because it speaks to his genius. He started writing the show in August and we started shooting at the end of September, beginning of October. So, and those scripts were so detailed and amazing and, you know, and so really, like, unless you're Jennifer Coolidge, you didn't really want to riff off those scripts, you know, because they're so brilliant. And, I mean, her riffs off anything are so brilliant. So, you know, that's so that's okay. Plus, she also said Mike's lines, but, you know, she brings her own kind of genius to it. So there was, you know, there was definitely things that came out. And, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, things are on the page, and when they come to life, then when you see the dynamics of the specific actors that are playing those roles, so you kind of, I think that's sort of what I was saying about the first scene that I had working with Mike, where he's kind of seeing who you are as an actor and all the different sort of colors that you have. So you definitely kind of find your rhythm with the dynamics with the characters when you start working together, particularly when you don't have any rehearsal or any kind of table read or anything. You're just on the fly, like, okay, where are we? But It was it's a brilliant group of actors and who turned out to be a lovely group of people. So, and we were all up for the challenge. And as I said, like full of joy and ready to have a great time.
And I especially loved your scenes with Jake Lacy. It's fun to just get to see you guys have this full out feud. Can you talk a little bit about Armand's dynamic there, that relationship?
Yeah, they were some of my favorite scenes because the conflict is so clear. Like these characters come into those scenes, they both want kind of an opposite thing. So, and there's no way that either of them is going to be satisfied at the end. You know, they're not going to get what they want really from each other. So it's just, it's like this perfect sort of acting exercise where one person wants one thing, the other person wants the opposite, and then you just, and go, you know? And Jake and I think Jake is similar to me in some ways where he's just such a great guy and so prepared, possibly like me, maybe a little over-prepared. So we came to set like really ready to go. And as soon as, you know, Mike calls action, we were just like, like at each other. So it was just kind of thrilling to work with an actor where you just like, just butting heads in such a great way in scenes that are written that way, you know, like it's just, it's very satisfying, I think. And for me, like as that character, being able to channel all my frustration at not standing up to the kind of obnoxious dicks that I've come across in my life and being able to just, you know, pour it all into the way I manipulate and treat that character was very satisfying and probably quite healing for me, I think. Therapeutic.
How cathartic. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I can't even imagine how much fun. So you must have been shooting in a very early, early mornings, right? If you were there when guests weren't in the hotel, if you were in that main area, you must have been shooting crazy hours. Was there like a ghost? I guess there must have been a real life Armand at the hotel. It must have been a sort of meta-like experience staying in the real life version of what you're acting out.
It was very odd. Yeah, living and working, because we couldn't leave that resort for the entire time we were shooting, two and a half months, whatever it was. So yeah, it was very meta, very, very odd, kind of eerie in the beginning when we had the resort to ourselves, and very like confronting in some ways. I remember one day where I was, you know, like, they were, you know, when the hotel wasn't open when we first got there, it was just a real kind of skeleton staff. And I didn't see an exact Armand, but there's always, you know, the managers and whatever have that kind of like, hi, great to see you. Like, you know, it's turning on the charm kind of thing. There was no sort of Armand clones for sure. But I remember this one day where, you know, I put in my laundry and it hadn't come back in a couple of days. And I was like about to pick up the phone and be like, excuse me. And I was like, oh my God, I'm turning into that guy. The dick who's like, where's my laundry? So I think it was probably good for us to be experiencing what it is to be in that hotel as we were, you know, playing these people who were caught up in that world. It was a very unique experience.
And how did you prepare loved ones for the final episode in your character storyline, especially? Did you give them any warning?
No. In fact, a lot of people said, why didn't you warn me? But I didn't want to give anything away, you know? Right. I feel like that's one of the things about the... I think maybe I did say something vague to my mom about just, like, be prepared. But she's pretty awesome. And by this point, she's, like, seen a lot of stuff. nothing much would shock her, I don't think. But I think she was shocked. Why wouldn't you be? Your son is, you know, doing some things on television that you never see on television. I thought it was fun and good to not let people in on what was going to be happening to me. So I got genuine responses.
I love it. Well, it was so nice to speak to you. Thank you so much for taking the time, especially on the back of all these travels. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, really lovely talking to you too.
That does it for this week's show. You can find us at VF.com covering our SAG Award predictions and talking about much of what else we talked about on this episode. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylos.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
You can also sign up to text us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7169. This might be a great time to start sending in some questions as we try to come up with some answers if we can. This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best wish to send out into the universe about this year's VF Oscar party goes to David Canfield.
We have to pray it's not over Zoom.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.